It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why hookah use is on the rise among high school students and whether or not that is cause for concern.
First, yesterday a federal judge cleared the way for a settlement between the National Football League and more than 4,500 retired NFL players over concussion-related claims.
Now, this preliminary settlement comes after months of legal wrangling by both sides, and it would provide compensation for players who are dealing with brain-related injuries or injuries that could develop later in life. The new settlement marks the first legal change in how the NFL addresses its ailing retirees, some of whom have been very critical about how the league has treated them after their playing days.
Here with us now to talk about the proposed settlement and what's next for the two sides is Ken Belson, sports reporter at the New York Times. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with this proposed settlement. What did this judge decide?
Well, the proposed settlement was technically proposed almost a year ago, and the original proposal had a cap on monetary awards of $675 million. The judge in January said that she thought that might not be enough to cover the 65-year length of the settlement, so she left it at that, and they came back with a new proposed settlement, which she has since approved, which includes no cap on damages. That's the headline number, so to speak.
So this includes damages. What else is perhaps going to be included in this package deal?
The players will also get something called baseline testing, which covers, preliminary tests that they can then use to compare if the players deteriorate. So they'll know their cognitive state when they're 35, and they'll be able to compare that to something when, say, they develop mild dementia or more serious dementia.
And let's get a little background on this. Can we talk about how this case got started and how we got to today?
It's somewhat unusual in class action terms. It started out as a set of small one-off lawsuits filed around the country in state and federal court by players and different sets of lawyers. And for ease of administration, they were put under something called multi-district litigation, or MDL, and consolidated in Philadelphia in federal court. And the first big test was last April, when the league essentially had the judge had a hearing where the league argued that all of these cases should be thrown out because they should be covered under the labor laws governing the NFL and the labor agreements with the union. The judge never ruled on that, which is a key threshold in a lot of these kind of sports labor cases, because the two sides decided to settle instead. And the lawyers for the players argue that that actually is a good thing because they might actually lose the first argument about whether it should be covered under labor law and might get zero. So at least by settling, they get something rather than potentially nothing. That was back, the arguments were in April, and then we led to the settlement, which was first announced in August last year.
So the cap on the damages has been removed. Is there any sort of ballpark figure about what kind of money we're looking at here from the NFL?
Well, the NFL basically says that they believe that their actuaries and economists tell them that the first number, the $675 million, is still essentially accurate, but they want to relieve any anxiety about whether the number will be accurate, and therefore they remove the cap. So they don't think the number is going to be a lot more than what they've already published. There are many others who say it's not so much the dollar figure, it's the terms of qualifying for the dollars. So in other words, what kind of illnesses do you need to get or have to get any money? And some players argue that they've only included a narrow set of categories, for example, Parkinson's disease, ALS, severe dementia. And, of course, football players get many other kinds of issues that are outside of those broad categories. And so, yes, there's $675 million set aside, but they're saying it's not going to cover the mass number of players and their injuries.
Now, this is being hailed as a landmark deal. How significant is it when it comes to the culpability of the NFL when it comes to concussions?
Well, as part of the settlement, the NFL admits no fault, so we'll never know, at least in this context, what they knew about concussions and what they did or didn't share with the retired players over the last 20-some-odd years. So we're not going to get any more insight into that. And then players who sign on to the settlement, assuming it's approved, it'll be majority of retired players, give up their rights to sue the NFL on this issue in the future. So, and this is not uncommon in a lot of class action cases. It sort of gives the league immunity from future cases. It's a landmark case insofar as the NFL has put up a ton of money potentially to pay for medical costs, but it's probably not going to shed a heck of a lot more light on what they knew and when.
Does this, though, signal that going forward the NFL is going to have to be a lot more careful about its policies regarding concussions?
Yes, and I think they probably already have been. But the bulk of the accusations stem from the 90s. And I think really the turning point from the NFL's perspective, to answer your question specifically, came sort of in 2009 when Roger Goodell, the commissioner, was asked to testify in front of Congress about concussions. I think that was their real big wake-up call. And you could argue that everything they've done since then, putting sideline extra neurologists on the sideline, having an extra set of eyes in the press box, identifying players who may have been concussed during a game, leaving the game protocol and coming back to play that protocol. All those things, I think, have come since 2009 and helped mitigate some of these problems. I don't know whether the injury figures fully tell the story, but I think the league has certainly been chastened by being hauled in front of Congress and, frankly, all of these lawsuits. I mean, it's a very damaging sight when your retirees are suing the league, not for some intellectual property argument or please share some money from video games with me, but basically accusing the league of neglecting them. And that could be a very damaging thing if this had gone to court or gone to trial.
What kind of reaction is this getting from the players who are involved?
It's a good question. You've got a universe of 20,000 players. Obviously, you've got 20,000 opinions. And I think in large part, and this is based mostly just on my anecdotal conversations with various retirees, is it breaks down partly generationally. I think older players see the league now as a very wealthy league, and they see their own role in that as diminished. In other words, they'll say, well, you know, when I played, I only had $2,000 a year pension benefit, or I made $15,000 a year and I was happy to get it. And now they see players with multi-million-dollar contracts. And whether it's out of jealousy or spite, I think they see the younger generation of players as getting off easy. And as a consequence, I think some of these older players are quite angry at the NFL. But really, it boils down to where they are health-wise. And I think anybody with serious injuries now is probably more willing to take the money now because they could use the money now, whereas a player who may be reasonably healthy and doesn't necessarily foresee themselves getting dementia may want to hold out for more in the future.
This isn't quite a done deal yet, but do you expect this to go through?
Good question. This is a approval of a preliminary settlement. The packets will be sent out to roughly 20,000 players. My sense is it will be approved by the players. The reason for that is somewhat technical in that in class action suits like this, the players don't literally have to vote yes. If they do nothing, they will be deemed to be in agreement with the settlement. And so there's a fairly high bar to get enough votes against the settlement to persuade the judge to not approve it. And so for that reason, I think it'll probably get approved. And I think also when the papers are in front of people and they finally see the numbers and they see that this is most of the way to the finish line, they may just say, you know what? What the heck? I'm just going to sign on. The other serious word of caution, which I'm sure any good lawyer will discuss with their client, is if you're going to opt out and preserve your legal rights to sue the NFL, what's that going to cost? There's no guarantee you'll get a penny. You're going to be taking on the NFL by yourself, and that could be a very expensive proposition. So for that reason, too, I think a lot of players are going to say, you know what, throw up their arms and let me just take what I could get.
Ken, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Ken Belson, sports reporter at The New York Times. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. After decades of anti-smoking public health campaigns, cigarette smoking among teens and young adults has dropped significantly. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control announced last month that cigarette smoking among U.S. high school students was at its lowest level in 25 years. But that doesn't mean that all tobacco use among teens has slowed down.
A new report out this week finds that about one in five high school students have tried smoking tobacco from a hookah, which has caught on in recent years, and teens of higher socioeconomic status were more likely to be hookah smokers. So the question, should we be concerned?
Joining us now to discuss this is Dr. Michael Weitzman, co-author of the study and professor of pediatrics, environmental medicine, and public health at the NYU Langone School of Medicine. Dr. Weitzman, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start out with a very basic question, first of all. For people who might not know what a hookah is, what is it?
Well, it's called a water pipe. I think many people, if they saw one, would know what it is. They've been around the United States for quite some time, but they've been around the Middle East for centuries. They are large glass bowls of varying size and beauty on which tobacco is placed on top and heated by charcoal. And then the smoker sucks in through a tube that's attached to this. And the smoke comes into this bowl and then is filtered through water and then goes up into the person's mouth and lungs.
Yeah, so when I think of hookahs, I think of old movies set in the Mideast, or I think of hipster hookah bars in large urban areas. The study, though, indicates that lots of teens are actually taking up smoking hookahs. Tell me about the numbers. What do they look like?
Well, the numbers are really quite terrifying. So it's about one in five high school students has used a hookah, and it's about one in 20 who's used one in the past month. Now, we've been profoundly successful in reducing cigarette smoking in the United States. There's been about a 35% decline just in the past 10 years. There's been a 135% increase in use of hookahs and things like e-cigarettes over the same time period. What's really most concerning is that there's this misconception that hookahs are safer than cigarettes, whereas what data exists suggests that they're as dangerous or possibly far more dangerous than smoking cigarettes.
Let's talk about that misconception first. Why is it that people might think that smoking a hookah is safer?
Well, the first thing is that anybody can go on a website and simply type in water pipe or hookah and come up with all sorts of advertisements that are aimed at adolescents and young people. And they're advertised as a safer alternative to tobacco, to cigarettes, rather. And they're described as a wonderful way to relax in a social setting with friends. And so you have targeting at youth, and we have not paid a lot of attention until the past 2 or 3 years to the emergence of these alternative tobacco products, which started with the changes in migration patterns to the United States, but have now been taken up by adolescents and young people. So it's intriguing to me that you mentioned hipster neighborhoods, because these data are the first data to show that it's wealthier and more educated kids who are more likely to be using this. So in the past, it's been poor people and immigrants and poor and people with mental health problems who have smoked cigarettes. This is likely, if it's not stopped, to be the first generation where we're going to lose 20 to 30 years of life expectancy for huge numbers of middle class and upper class people. So it's really, from a societal point of view, as well as a public health point of view, it's an epidemic deserving of profound attention.
Yeah, that's interesting because, as I say, when I think of hookahs, I think of their size and sort of the location, that aspect of them, where they're not very handy. You know, you have to go somewhere. You don't really carry them around with you, although there are these things, I understand, the pen hookahs or the hookah pens right now. But it seems like that would limit it somehow. But you're telling me that it's not so, that people are going out of their way to congregate, and it's more of a social thing to do than smoking alone.
Well, you're asking a number of remarkable questions that get at the problem. So the attention to date, which is becoming very frenetic amongst the public health community, which is very terrified, is about hookah bars. All right? But all around urban settings, and I would imagine in many settings in Wisconsin as well, are emerging tobacconists that advertise that they sell hookahs and shisha. And so they're all over, for example, New York. I'm talking about hundreds of these places. So people are purchasing these, and they must be using them at home. But there's no data on that. Everybody focuses on the hookah bars, and they do tend to cluster, both in New York and the other communities that we've looked at, in communities with younger people, what we used to call counterculture. You use the term hipster. And around universities. Now, one of the things that everybody should know is that many people share a hookah. So you and I and other people, if I were with you right now, could be sharing the same hookah at the same time. So we'd be blowing into this thing and breathing in, and we'd be exchanging bacteria. In the developing world, it's been shown to be a very effective way to transmit tuberculosis. So infectious diseases are going to be transmitted, as well as profoundly dangerous levels of carcinogens, things that ultimately result in cancer. But this is a relatively new field of research. In large part, it's being propelled because the Federal Drug Administration can only regulate tobacco products, and many of the hookah bars claim that they use something called shisha, which is herbal and doesn't contain tobacco. We have finished other studies that show that that's not true, that every hookah bar we've been in New York, they use tobacco. So providing that sort of information, as well as research on the untoward effects on health, are desperately needed to help propel legislation. But the public needs to know that despite the appearance of this being a cool thing to do, there are some studies that suggest that an hour using a hookah, which is about the time of an average hookah session, may be the equivalent of 5 packs of cigarettes.
1 hour?
So it's possible. That's what some studies show. And, you know, if you go to a hookah bar, you pay for 45 minutes to an hour of doing this. So if you're going to spend the evening there, who's ever smoked 5 to 15 packs of cigarettes? So you're talking about middle class and upper class kids, because this is expensive, destroying their lungs, destroying their hearts. Now that's speculation because nobody has the data long term. But acutely we've looked, and you can measure in the blood acute inflammatory responses. So your whole body is responding. It's not just your lungs and your heart, but you can measure things in the blood that white blood cells produce when they are challenged and threatened. So this is a very dangerous epidemic that's largely been invisible, but I can assure you it will not be invisible for a long time.
So, yeah, I wanted to ask, you mentioned data collection there. I imagine data collection is continuing, but you also mentioned legislation. What types of legislation, regulation, do you think people ought to be talking about that we ought to be looking at?
Well, many places in the United States have Clean Air Acts where you're not allowed to smoke cigarettes in public places, in restaurants, in bars, in parks. So that's been very effective, but the thing that's worked the best has been public education and taxation. So right now there's no taxing going on of this shisha, the tobacco that's smoked. And there's no taxing of the places that are selling these. So there's a whole array of legislation that you could do. You could stop sales to youngsters. You could stop advertising on the web or in teenage magazines, just like we did with cigarettes. There are a host of things that have proven profoundly, profoundly effective with cigarettes.
And I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it, Dr. Weitzman. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
My honor. Thank you so much. Bye.
Dr. Michael Weitzman is a professor of pediatrics, environmental medicine, and public health at the NYU Langone School of Medicine.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Still ahead, new writing about Wisconsin and a childhood spent on the greens of a miniature golf course named Tom Thumb.
But first, the 1998 film The Truman Show told the story of a man whose entire life was the subject of a TV show, his every move captured on hidden cameras.
While that story was fictional, our next guest is a psychiatrist who says he has met more and more patients who truly believe that they, too, were living in a world much like that of The Truman Show. He says it speaks to a greater hypothesis that culture helps to shape modern delusions.
Dr. Joel Gold is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine, and he's the co-author of Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. Dr. Gold, welcome to Central Time.
Good being here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start by getting into your background a little bit. You were attending psychiatrist at the Bellevue Hospital Center in New York for 9 years, and you call your training there baptism by fire. For people who aren't familiar, what makes Bellevue so remarkable?
Well, Bellevue is the oldest public hospital in the country, and it's well regarded for its psychiatric department. We tend to see often the sickest of the sick. People are brought to Bellevue from around the city when they're in great distress psychiatrically. A lot of suicidal patients, a lot of homicidal patients, unfortunately, and a lot of patients with very severe psychosis, that is, people who are hearing voices or have delusions. That's the topic of our book.
And in your book, you describe a number of patients that you worked with. And one of the first people you introduce is someone that you started to call the dude. You first saw him. You thought, this is a guy I can handle. He's probably just having a rough time. He broke up with his girlfriend. But this guy's problems went deeper. Tell us about the dude.
Yeah. After my first month of training at Bellevue, wherein I had seen a lot of the very sick patients that I just referred to, I did see this young man and waiting in the waiting area, and he seemed just like that, a very, you know, sort of kind of slacker college student, so to speak. And I said, oh, come on in, you know, expecting to hear just that. And he told me instead that he had been killing animals and drinking their blood in order to absorb their spirit, and his thoughts had turned to perhaps human beings, including his mother, which is very distressing to him, understandably. So he walked in himself, and naturally he was admitted upstairs.
And what did his malady, his delusions, tell you about what he was experiencing?
Well, to be honest, it's hard to know. At that time, being in the psychiatric emergency room, you know, when someone is considered a danger to themselves or others, they are admitted and sent to one of the about 10 or a dozen inpatient units that we have at Bellevue dedicated to psychiatry. So really, it would depend on, once he got upstairs, the story that he told, whether, say, voices were commanding him to perform these acts, or perhaps that he had some unusual belief that if he did, you know, these things, or if he had to do these things, then something would or would not happen, which, you know, would entail a particular delusion. Fortunately or unfortunately, I was not in a position to treat him over the course of time. I just saw him, you know, in terms of his presentation.
And he's someone who was, you know, experiencing mental illness, delusion, and you, as you went along from these years in Bellevue, began to notice a pattern in what you were seeing when delusional patients reported to you. What was that pattern?
Yeah, in about 2003, I saw a gentleman who said that his entire life was a reality television show. All of his family members were reading from a script, and there were cameras everywhere. And they were essentially broadcasting his life around the world for everyone to see other than himself, and he had not consented, you know, to be in this reality show. Initially, I didn't think too much of it. You know, again, we see a whole number of very unusual beliefs at Bellevue. So I just made a mental note and kind of moved on. But several months later, I saw a second person who had a similar idea, and then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, finally, at which time I realized that this was, you know, something more than a passing sort of coincidence. They all believed this very same thing, that their lives were reality television shows. So I named it the Truman Show delusion after the movie wherein Truman Burbank, the character played by Jim Carrey in the movie, his life, in fact, is a reality show that that he's not aware of.
This is an interesting one because we live in an age where there is surveillance everywhere. As Americans, we're becoming increasingly aware that the government is, you know, maybe listening to phone calls, following phone logs, tracking internet use and things like that. So how does reality overlap with the territory of delusion?
You know, that's a really important question. Initially, when we started thinking about this, when I say we, my brother Ian, who's a philosopher, and I have written this book, we started thinking about popular culture, reality television, and the like. And, you know, it's, I think, worthwhile looking at the culture of instant stardom, people without particular talent being famous, and how that might impact people with mental illness. But over the course of the last years, as you suggest, you know, these issues coming to light about PRISM, the fact that someone might be, well, I suppose they don't need to be listening in on this call since it's on the radio, but, you know, imagining that people are listening to every call, reading our emails, what impact might that have on someone who is, so to speak, teetering on the brink of psychosis? Would that more than just color their delusion, but perhaps tip them into psychosis? That's really the question that we're asking right now.
So you're looking pretty much at the question of how culture shapes madness. And in this case, it's our culture of surveillance, which we're becoming more and more accustomed to and grappling with, you know, as ordinary citizens. But mm-hmm. What is that link when you look at psychiatry?
Well, over the course of decades and probably centuries, the content of delusion reflected the culture. So, for instance, in the, let's say, backdrop of the Cold War, people had the delusion that the KGB or the CIA might be following them. And that was filling in their persecutory belief. And as that changed, we might have seen other kinds of persecutory delusions, maybe Al-Qaeda is targeting me and the like. And this also reflects how culture changes. When we were a more religious nation, there were more religious delusions. Now, as time has moved on and the country as a whole has become less religious, we see fewer of the delusions, perhaps I am Jesus, or, you know, I have a particular direct relationship with God that goes beyond, you know, general religious belief. So for a long time, we had the sense that no matter what the delusion was, be it persecutory, paranoid, grandiose, and other very common delusions, that culture just sort of filled in the space. And now we're actually thinking much more of culture inducing possibly delusions themselves as opposed to just filling in the blanks, depending on what era we're living in.
That's a pretty intense statement, that the culture itself can induce some of the delusions and mental illness you're talking about.
Well, again, it's really an open question. We're not suggesting that, you know, watching The Real Housewives is going to make you crazy, although I can understand, you know, that, why that might be a legitimate question. It's really much more of, you know, the serious sort of surveillance era that we live in, the fact that we have closed-circuit televisions everywhere, you know, the details that we talked about with respect to the government and large corporations, the recent Facebook story, you know, in terms of manipulating or collecting data about people's psychological responses, again, without their knowledge or consent. You know, what impact might this have? I think for people who are sort of firmly rooted in sanity, so to speak, it's very unlikely that any of these particular ideas or stories would make someone psychotic. Similarly, someone who is already in the hands of psychosis, so to speak, yes, it'll just probably fill in the blanks, as I was talking about a few minutes ago. But there is this gray area where people may just be coming psychotic or just on the verge, something we call prodromal psychosis, where they might go either way. You know, often a young man or woman in their late teens or early 20s, they may be having some of this thought that things seem a little weird, but they're really not quite sure how things are different. And for those people, I wonder very, very much whether someone who was living, let's say, 100 or 200 years ago with the same genetics, the same brain, but not living in the society that we live in now, whether they might not become psychotic, whereas some today might be. We have evidence that environmental factors such as living in an urban environment or being an immigrant or being a survivor of child abuse, any of these things actually do raise the likelihood of someone becoming psychotic. So if these environmental factors can actually increase the risk of someone becoming psychotic, you know, why not other environmental factors like the ones we're talking about?
So if someone feels that they may be susceptible, or someone's family member feels that someone that they love might be susceptible to this kind of delusion, and here we are in this culture that you just described that's filled with cameras and surveillance, what sort of advice do you give them?
Well, that's a tough question. I think, first and foremost, if a family member or loved one is concerned, they should be brought to a mental health professional. I think that's always the most important thing when anyone is concerned. Now, of course, you can imagine in, with someone who has Truman Show delusion that that's the last place that they're going to want to go. Or if they do, they're going to think that the psychiatrist is an actor as well. And so they're unlikely to listen to me more than anyone else. So that's one sort of extra difficulty with people who have this form of delusion. In terms of how do you address people who have this belief, it's challenging. I think if someone says, well, you know, the government is listening to my phone calls 10, 20, 30 years ago, of course, we would have said, well, this person is, you know, most likely having a delusion of persecution or paranoia. Now, of course, that in and of itself is not evidence that someone is delusional. Of course, you and I might have that, well, not just concern, but that knowledge. But if someone has that symptom, so to speak, or that belief in the context, the greater context of other symptoms of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, hearing voices, not sleeping, having other unusual beliefs, then they do need treatment. And when they say, but, you know, here's the front page of the newspaper that says the government is following me in a sense, I think it's probably best to acknowledge that and say, yes, that is in fact the case, and that is happening to all of us, but these other symptoms that you're experiencing, those are not usual for other people. And so that's the key, that perhaps someone needs psychiatric help.
We're talking right now with Joel Gold, co-author of the book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What questions do you have for Dr. Gold about the Truman Show delusion? Is it more difficult these days to separate reality from delusion? And how do you think that science might need to adapt to better understand how culture shapes mental illness? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll be back after this check of the news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Joel Gold, a psychiatrist and co-author of the book Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about how culture affects someone's experience of mental illness? Is it possible for the culture to induce mental health issues? And what more do we yet have to understand about this topic? There's a lot here. Share your thoughts and questions with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Gold, why do you think it is that the psychiatric field hasn't taken a lot of time looking at mental illness and delusional behavior from this angle, from the area of culture shaping madness, instead of it coming from somewhere inside?
Yeah, that's a real concern for us. You know, we think that neuroscience has so much to offer, but we are concerned that psychiatry has become so enamored with neuroscience, brain science, and genetic study that they and we have largely ignored cultural and environmental factors. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that one might have higher incidence of psychosis if one lives in a city or is an immigrant or has suffered child abuse. So again, these are well-established facts, well-known, particularly in the United Kingdom, but in the United States, if you ask the average psychiatrist or the average psychiatric researcher, they probably wouldn't even know that those findings have been well established. So if that's the case, more and more monies are being granted to genetic and neuropsychiatric research, and of course treatments follow, that way, pharmacological and otherwise. But if we're ignoring the environmental and cultural factors, people are going to stop looking at them, and we think that's a huge mistake. Darwin said that, things, people, animals evolve because they live in a particular environment. And so that's sort of the core of science. And yet, for some reason, people are so concerned about what's happening in the skull that they forget to look around it, I'm afraid.
So if psychiatry were to change its approach and start looking more at these cultural factors, what do you expect would change?
Well, as I suggest, I think that in large part, the very culture of psychiatry might change in terms of both treatment, in terms of when we interview a patient, paying more attention not just to what medications they've been on in the past, what medical conditions they might have, but more of their life history. And of course, I'm not suggesting that psychiatrists don't ask those questions. They do. But in my experience, it tends to be a little bit sort of glossed over. Yes, someone might have had this particular experience, but, let's leave it to the side. The person is hearing voices, so let's give them the right antipsychotic medication so they'll be better and, we can send them home. So that's first and foremost. And, of course, again, with the issue of government funding, there are fewer and fewer dollars to go around. And if people have this sort of monomaniacal, if I could say, focus on the brain and genes, then that's where all the funding is going to go. And I think without funding, the findings that I recently stated would never have come to light. And so what other factors are we going to learn about, or could we learn about, if the appropriate research was being done? And right now, again, I think that might be under threat.
Now, your book looks primarily at the way culture shapes mental illness, but you also want us to think about mental illness and the way that we treat it in our culture. What do you think is the most common misperception that we have about people with mental illness?
Well, one in particular that we touch on upon the book is the nature of how we treat people with psychosis. Again, people with depression, anxiety, the neurotic, so-called worried well patients that come to me, people might be on a medication, but, at least I believe very strongly in talk therapy, and we want to know what kind of stress they might be under, again, what family history they have of these illnesses, what their life is like. With psychosis, people tend to jump to their prescription pad. Again, if someone's hearing voices or seeing things or has a delusion of one kind or another, yes, again, they might pay some lip service to their psychosocial life, but first and foremost, again, what is the best medication for this person? And in doing so, I think that we're doing a great disservice. There has been a lot of work, again, primarily in the United Kingdom, about certain kinds of talk therapy, primarily cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which in the past has been well established to help, again, people with depression and anxiety. But for many years, and again, even decades, the idea of doing talk therapy with someone with psychosis was almost unheard of. But we now have good evidence that approaching patients in a particular way and talking to them, even if they have delusions, we can help them with talk therapy. And that's one thing I think, again, most North American psychiatrists aren't aware of. And if they were, that might change their view a little bit.
So using different prongs there, medication and talk therapy.
Yeah, I think that often both might work better than either alone. I certainly, do psychotherapy with patients who do not require, or I don't think they require any medication. And there are some people who don't do talk therapy, and, they're comfortable prescribing medications, and, all power to them. I'm not judging, but I do think, again, when you're talking about, let's say, the average depressed person, no psychiatrist would argue that either or both might be of help. But when you talk about psychosis, I would think, you know, 98% of psychiatrists would say, well, okay, what antipsychotic medication are you giving them? They would not think, oh, are you considering cognitive behavioral therapy for psychosis as a treatment, at least here in this country. Again, in the United Kingdom, it's considered one of the first-line treatments for psychosis. But here, it's fallen much, much further down. I think in time, it's picking up a little bit of steam, but on the average psychiatrist's desk, it's really not even an implement.
So Truman Show aside, how has your practice changed as we move into this era of social media and interconnectivity and people having access to huge amounts of data and also like-minded groups of people just able to connect with each other? What's changed for you as a psychiatrist?
Again, it doesn't affect just psychosis, of course. People, particularly younger people that I treat, their entire lives are lived in public, so to speak. And so I think young minds don't fully understand what impact that has. And frankly, we adults don't really understand what impact that might have on people who are weaned on iPads. And for ourselves as adults, the notion of what's private and what's public can have a huge impact. And I think that's something we need to look at. Again, for all manner of things, you know, cyberbullying as one example. Unfortunately, we've heard stories of young adolescents who've taken their own lives because of people, essentially bullying them online, and they just cannot escape it. And what impact that will have on anyone, the notion that we have this information overload, and it's very hard for people to sort of shut it down. I'm not saying that, technology is a bad thing, by no means. I use it every day myself. But where do we draw the line? At what point do we think that, well, again, let's say a young college student says, I've got 10,000 friends. Well, do they have 10,000 friends or do they have 10,000 online friends, but no actual friends, no human beings that they spend time with face to face? And I think that can have a corrosive effect on people's development and experience of life.
Dr. Gold, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Joel Gold is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine and co-author of the new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness.